You're listening to Interviews with Adam. I am your host, Adam Miller. And today we have a special guest who is an organizer, a producer, so to speak, of a lot of the music that is coming out of a new generation, but with a tie back to the older generation. His name is Kevin Twitt. He's a part of Indelible Grace. He's also a campus minister. A lot of backgrounds, a lot of hats that he wears. But Kevin, thank you so much for being a part of our program.
No, it's my pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
Give us a little bit about your background, because all of these things, although you wear many hats and you're doing a lot of different things, they all kind of fall under one umbrella. So tell us a little bit about your passion and your heart and the ministry that you have as a campus minister.
Sure. So I grew up in the Baltimore area, got converted in high school, went to Berklee College of Music up in Boston. So I know there's some connections with Sondheim and Boston. I actually went to Ruggles Street Baptist Church in college for a while, which has a connection with your program, from what I understand. After that, I moved down to Nashville. My senior year at college is when I first started teaching. We started a Christian fellowship, and I kind of got a little taste and some experience in teaching, like in a Bible study, and then moved to Nashville, worked in the Christian music industry as a recording engineer. So got to work on lots of cool records doing that. And then was also just feeling like I wasn't getting as much opportunities to be involved in kind of gospel ministry and teaching and preaching, which I'd kind of gotten a little taste of there in college. And so kind of around the same time, two things happened. One, the church I was at, Christ Community Church, which had a lot of Christian music people in it, they wanted to start a college ministry. And so I volunteered to help with that. And then a friend of mine named David Mullen had gotten signed to Warner Brothers, and so I decided to leave the recording studio and go out on the road with him. Anyway, fast forward, did music for a few years, even won a Dove Award, you know, for the New Artist Year, but you've probably never heard of David. You might have heard of his wife, Nicole Simon, and she went on to be more popular than we ever were. But that kind of came to a close, and I, at that point, was feeling like I love playing guitar, but I really love teaching my college students in the Sunday school class. And so I decided seminary was the next step to get more training, really to focus on that. Kind of thought that I was turning my back on music, at least vocationally. And when I got out of seminary, Christ Community Church called me back to Nashville to work with a ministry called RUF, Reformed University Fellowship, which is a Presbyterian campus ministry, one of about 140 campuses now. And they called me back to be the college pastor and to start that work at Belmont University in Nashville. And I don't know if you know about Belmont, but it's, you know, half the students are music or music business majors. And so it kind of, you know, music was, you know, a connection that I had with a lot of those students. You know, the Indelible Grace thing really came out of that. In the RUF communities, there was a bit of singing old hymns kind of adapted to guitar. So some traditional tunes that would work on guitar, because we normally were just setting up like in a classroom or something. And then some even new tunes that they were, had started to dabble in even before I got involved in it. And but the main thing was really a pastoral concern. I was finding that I would have this regular conversation with students that I was ministering to who would be talking about different doubts and struggles they had. And they would often be concluding that they probably weren't Christians if they were having doubts and struggles. And I know you guys have been talking a lot about the Psalms. And I began to realize as I talked to them, like, have you ever read the Psalms? Because that seems to be a regular expression of people's faith, these kind of struggles and doubts. It's all over the place in the Psalms. And as it turned out, my students weren't reading the Psalms. They weren't singing the Psalms. Began to realize that so much of their kind of understanding of what the Christian life feels like, the normal Christian life, was based on the songs they were singing. And honestly, the songs were lying to them. The songs were saying things like, if you're, you know, I love you all the time and I don't want to ever do anything else other than love you all the time forever and ever. And that just wasn't real and true to their experience. And I didn't believe that that was true to the normal Christian experience, at least that the Psalms are a good standard for us to understand. And so I began looking for some better songs to sing, because I felt like the songs that my students were singing were undermining what I was trying to teach them about the gospel and about the normal Christian life. And that's kind of what led us to some of these hymns and looking in some old hymnals to try and find songs that dealt with suffering and struggle. And I would find texts like, Dear Refuge of My Weary Soul, by this Baptist hymn writer, 18th century Baptist hymn writer, Ann Steele. And I just thought, that's the kind of stuff that my students are feeling. And it would be so great if we could sing songs like that today. And so we just would have to come up with a melody if we're going to sing that. Because I was getting those, some of those old hymns out of old hymnals. You know, pre-Civil War hymnals don't have music in them. They're just texts. And a lot of these hymns I was finding that I wanted to sing had dropped out of hymnals 200 years ago. And so we sometimes would sing them to pre-existing tunes, but sometimes I'd come up with a tune, or I'd tell my students, hey, let's sing this one. Somebody want to come up with a tune? We'll try it next week.
It's so interesting that you're tying in the young people with the old. It seems that so much of contemporary Christian music has been throwing out the baby with the bathwater and starting afresh, and you kind of cited that as well, talking about songs that they're lying to us. They're just not true expressions of our heart, especially the ones that we see in the Psalms, Dear Refuge yeah. of My Weary Soul. That must be a real a good challenge, but also something that's very fruitful to connect young people to the heritage of our faith, right?
Right. Yeah, I like to use the phrase I found in a book years ago, roots and wings. We want to have our young people rooted in the tradition. I want my students to know that the church is bigger than people that talk like them and sing like them. So I like them singing these and vows and those sorts of things. But we also want them to be able to add their own voice. So you don't want to have just traditionalism, but you also, yeah, like you say, don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. I found a sign in an antique store once that kind of captured what I felt was going on with this Indelible Grace movement, and it said this, that my grandmother saved it, my mother threw it away, and now I'm buying it back. And that, you know, in the 90s is where a lot of my students were at, and a lot of my friends, feeling like this music that's being marketed as college music, college, you know, worship, just wasn't connecting with some of my students, and particularly issues of struggle. And I would say also explicit teaching about the cross and about the gospel, like those were really missing in a lot of those songs. And so we kind of started our little countercultural movement, even though in the main church service, they were singing a lot of that music. In our college Sunday school class, we were singing this other music and found that we really, you know, this group of friends came to fall in love with these old hymn texts, and we never intended to share it with the world so much. I mean, we were doing this music for years before we thought maybe it would be fun to record some of it, and made that first record. My background had been as a recording engineer, and I had friends in Nashville that let us use a studio, and had no idea how it would resonate with people. But it really, you know, people responded to it in just a remarkable way.
You know, I think a lot of our listeners probably share a concern that is growing in the church today about sending their kids off to college. And here you work at a secular school, Belmont, and you're ministering
technically, technically a Christian school.
Oh, technically yeah. A Christian school. I didn't know that.
It is a Christian school, yeah, but the students don't have to profess faith to go there, but the faculty are supposed to.
But you have this college campus ministry ministering to these kids, and you are allowing them to kind of be in the driver's seat, so to speak, of their own faith, of getting closer to God, but connecting them with great roadmaps. I don't know if that's a good enough illustration, but that's kind of how I've
seen what you're doing. No, I think you're onto something there. I mean, one of the things I tell people is I don't know if this movement would have started if I wasn't doing college ministry. Because college ministry, really, you have the opportunity to try things, and there's less, you know, negative feedback if it doesn't go so well. Like if I'd been the worship director at a church and I suggested retuning some hymns, I probably would have gotten more pushback. But the college students, my college students didn't know hymns. Like some of them had grown up in churches and had never sung hymns. And the ones that had sung hymns maybe knew less than 10. So to them, they were all new songs, even though they were old texts. And so it also, because it was this smaller kind of context, it wasn't like get up in front of 3,000 people and sing this new song. We, in our group of maybe 100 people, yeah, you could let a student, you know, work on a tune, and then we could try it. And if it went well, great. If not, it's no big deal. I do think there was less of a pressure to be professional and glitzy, and that enabled a fledgling movement to develop. And even on the first record, we used 30 different students because I wanted different people to have a part as much as we could. And I could have used professional musician friends of mine. I'd been in the industry for a while and had a lot of those people even in my church. But I really wanted it to be kind of our thing. I don't know if you know the Olney Hymns, which is a collection of hymns that John Newton and William Cooper put together, hymns like Amazing Grace and, you know, just so many over, you know, what is it? There's a Fountain Filled with Blood. And so many of these marvelous hymns were in that collection. And John Newton wrote in the preface that he wanted the hymnal not just to be a collection of hymns, but a monument to the friendship that God had built between he and William Cooper. And that's what I've always felt about these Indelible Grace CDs. It's, I've always used students that have come through our ministry and then alumni now. And, of course, I'm at Belmont, so I have so many fabulous, really talented people there. I had the guys in Jars of Clay were in my Sunday school class, you know, college-age guys who dropped out of college and had moved to Nashville. So I had, you know, a lot of talented people, you know, that maybe other people don't have. But part of the project was even feeling like I should get some of these people to do some of this music for the church. It would be, it'd be a great thing. But I had another, you know, little pastoral agenda too. If I'm able to talk about this, I always want people to understand it was a pastoral agenda that drove this. And then it just resonated with people and people bought the record and gave us money to make the next record. The next record, we've made 9 of them now. So it's kind of crazy, how it just keeps going.
I wanted to build on that, what you were just saying about having a pastoral approach and the idea that you're ministering to these young college students. What has been the result of them being ministered, not just through your teaching and the preaching of the word, but through their own involvement in spending time in the text? You talked about there being a need for them to have a deeper foundation in their faith. What has been the direct result that you've seen from that?
Right. Yeah. So when I was talking about, you know, the pastoral agenda that was driving this, like one of my things that I figured out was if I could give old hymnals or reprinted copies of old hymnals like Gadsby's Hymns or Spurgeon put out a hymnal that you can get a reprint of. It's 1,000 hymn texts in Spurgeon's hymnal and no music. And I would buy copies of those and give them to some of my students who are songwriters. Not just hoping that they would write a song, but hoping they would read it through devotionally. And if they found a text that they liked or that resonated with them in some way, then they might try to put it to music. Now, I knew as a songwriter that if you're going to put music to a text, you're going to have to inhabit that text. And so you're really going to have to study it and indwell it, which would be good for them as Christians, whether or not we got a song that would benefit the church. You know, that would be awesome if that happened too. But I really was finding a lot of my songwriters were really connecting with hymn texts that were connecting head and the heart. And so, yeah, I saw that happening. As far as, you know, the long-term thing, what's been cool for me, a couple kind of touchstone moments. One was 10 years after the first record in 2010, we had the opportunity to do a hymn sing in Nashville at a place called the Ryman Auditorium, which is a famous venue. It's where bluegrass music first, you know, debuted. It's where the Grand Ole Opry was. It's this wonderful venue, 2,200 people here in Nashville. And we were able to be able to do a hymn sing there. We recorded it. It's our this live record. We even made a movie, a documentary talking about where this movement came from. And it was the opportunity for my students to reflect 10 years later on this record and what these hymns have meant to them. And so that's really powerful. We put that up on YouTube. So it's Roots and Wings, the story of Indelible Grace and the REF hymns. And people can watch that if they want. But also then just about a month ago, we had the 20th anniversary of doing REF at Belmont. I've been doing that ministry now for 20 years. And of course we couldn't imagine celebrating 20 years without having a hymn sing as well as testimonies from students, you know, what kind of the ministry of REF meant to them. And it was great to see the interweaving of the songs and the gospel that they had learned maybe from my preaching. And honestly, you know, I think in the past, pastors and hymn writers were often the same people. So many of our great preaching heroes spent a lot of time involved in church music. I mean, people don't realize that Charles Spurgeon put together a hymnal, or J.C. Ryle put together a hymnal. John Calvin worked on church music virtually his entire career. Martin Luther, you know, put out a hymnal and issued a call for other poets to take up his work and noise the gospel abroad, is what he said. I love that phrase. So many of these people were very involved in church music. In our day and age, we seem to have farmed out church music to musicians, and then pastors just preach. And yet I found in my ministry, well, it's like Colossians, you know, says that we want to get the word to dwell among us, the you there is plural, richly through singing psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, right? There's something about the gospel, the word about Christ dwelling in us richly as we sing it. Because Augustine said, he who sings prays twice. Music has a way of intensifying whatever it is we're doing, whether it's praise or lament. And I think in a lot of ways the church in the last 50 years has almost tried to treat human beings, to use Jamie Smith's word, as brains on sticks, and not attend to the holistic human being, emotions, will, understanding. And I think these hymns really connect some of those things together that I think were lost in the modernism age.
Your latest album is Looking to Jesus, which is perfect for our theme for this year. We've been looking at Hebrews 12:2, the author, the finisher of our faith. And this is really what I get the sense of from talking with you, is really the goal of bringing these hymns to your college students so that they will see the person and the work and glory in that, in Christ. What was the inspiration behind this album?
Right. So it's titled Look to Jesus, Indelible Grace 7, but it's actually our ninth record. It's a little confusing, but we did a live record and then we did an acoustic record that we didn't number the same way. So, you know, when we go into time to make a record, it usually is a matter of, if I have songs and I have money and I have time, then we get to make a record. Because my full-time gig is a college pastor. Though now at this point, you know, I'm thinking more broadly about the impact of these records than just my college students. Because we've been doing this for a while, and there's a lot of people that appreciate this music and follow it. And but for this one, so I don't really go into it with a theme per se. I spend a lot of time collecting old hymnals, reading old hymnals, finding texts that I think have dropped out of use but would be worth singing again. And so I'll gather those and collect them. And when it's time to make another record, I'll maybe have 30 or 40 texts that I think would be worth trying to retune. And I'll send them out to some of my students and some of my former students. Then they'll kind of work on them. They'll send them back to me. We'll get together in my living room with maybe 20, 25 students, and we'll sing through a bunch of the songs and see which ones seem to work congregationally. I think it's always important to try them out. And then we'll go into the record. Now, this record comes out of a season in our community where a lot of people have been through some really, really hard stuff. And the last record was, it's called The Joy Beyond the Sorrow. And I guess the theme that emerged from that one was the idea that sorrow is real, but there's joy beyond the sorrow. It's real, but it's not ultimate. And this one was more about tasting God's goodness now, even in the midst of the brokenness. And Look to Jesus, you know, that phrase comes from one of the hymns. The hymn is called Come Ye Souls, by Sin Afflicted. And that one, it's got this great line. It says, Come ye souls by sin afflicted, bowed or bowed with fruitless sorrow down, by the broken law convicted, through the cross, behold the crown. Look to Jesus, look to Jesus, look to Jesus. Mercy flows through him alone. So it's even in the midst of your sorrow, sometimes, you know, you can even try to earn God's favor by your own sorrow. I don't know if you've ever thought about that concept, but the idea that you can kind of beat yourself up as a way to try to earn God's sympathy. And I know Charles Spurgeon, great Baptist preacher, said years ago, you know, it's by his stripes that we're healed. Never make your stripes or your wounds a rival to the wounds of Christ. Sometimes we can do that. We can just sort of sit in our pity and our sorrow and not look to Jesus. But, you know, through the cross, behold the crown. I love that image. And look to Jesus. Mercy flows through him alone. You don't qualify yourself to receive grace by what you do or even by what you suffer. And sometimes, you know, even especially if suffering goes on for a long, long time, you can almost start to feel like God owes you. And, you know, we wanted to just, you know, when I found that line, that idea in this hymn, I thought, oh, that's an aspect that I've tried to explain in preaching, but I didn't know any songs that said that. So when I found a text that seemed to get at that, I thought that would be helpful for us to sing.
Yeah, that's so important. You know, what we have been seeing, especially as we're working through the Psalms, is that constant that He is our refuge and strength. Psalm 46, even if the earth is removed, that's such a great image. Even if the earth was taken out from under our feet, we'd still have a ground to stand on, because our faith is so much more secure than what we have to put in this world.
Yes, absolutely.
One of the songs I really appreciate on this album is Heal Us, and it's not just the song itself, which is such a beautiful combination of gospel, but it's also a combination of two different schools. There's a great history behind it, so maybe you could share a little bit of that story with our listeners.
Right. So, like I've mentioned, RUF were on about 140 campuses, a couple historic black colleges. Though the PCA, which is the Presbyterian Church of America, is where RUF comes from. It's a denominational ministry, conservative Presbyterian group. And generally, our denomination is not very diverse. So even the music that's kind of come out of RUF, when a couple of these historic black colleges now have RUF chapters, and they would come to our national conference, it was always kind of a challenge for them to figure out, like, how do we find our place here musically. Like I said, the idea of roots and wings, like, they come with a great church music tradition that's very different than kind of the white music that we're doing. How can they add their voice to it? So that had been some discussions been going on about that. And then we had the opportunity at our national summer conference down in Florida for a couple years in a row. Belmont and Jackson State University were able to lead the worship together for our national conference. And that was fun. What we would do is Jackson State would lead a couple nights, Belmont would lead a couple nights, and then we have that fifth night where we'd lead together and kind of have a combined band. And that was just really great. Some great friendships developed, mutual respect, appreciation, and also even have to work through, like, which songs can work, which ones are bridging songs, which ones are maybe so stylistically, you know, connected to one culture or another that they didn't cross over as well. So that kind of was all going on. Well, this song, Heal Us, Emmanuel, and it's by William Cooper. It comes out of the Only Hymns that I mentioned earlier. I've had that text and been working on a tune for that probably for 15 years and just never felt like it quite was there where I wanted it. Some churches I know even have been singing an earlier version of it that I did, but I never felt like it was quite there enough to record on one of our Indelible Grace records. And got together with Lucas Morton, one of my current students who leads the worship at our RUF group at Belmont. And he's a great gospel piano player, and he kind of suggested some changes that really made it more of a kind of black gospel stylistic song. And that was around the time of all the Ferguson kind of stuff was going on. A lot of people in my circles, friends, you know, fellow pastors, really trying to figure out, like, where is the church in the middle of this stuff? And I think even for a lot of my students, to see the flare-up of these racial tensions was really shocking, really hit people hard. Because in a lot of ways, you can live in a bubble and feel like we're getting better, aren't we? It's not still the 50s or the 60s. And then you're like, well, for some people, they don't feel like things are much better at all. And I think that was a real sobering thing. And a lot of people were just feeling the weight of that. And this song, Heal Us, just emerged as we were working on this record as, like, the right song for the right time. Because I think that the key to coming together is for all of us, you know, to fall down at the cross, right? And you see in Ephesians, you know, the gospel of God reconciling men and women to Himself is also about reconciling men and women to each other. That as we each are reconciled to God, it's almost like a pyramid. As we get closer to God, we're also brought inevitably together. And that is part of this great cosmic mystery that Paul unveils there in Ephesians, right? So we were able to record this song, and I thought, wouldn't it be great to get the Jackson State group to be able to sing on this? And Blessing had been a guy on American Idol, but he'd been a Belmont student at Cumbria. So I thought it would be great if he would sing it. And he said yes, and he did a fabulous job. And then I really wanted to get the Jackson State students to be on it. It was a little tricky. I couldn't get them up to Nashville, and I couldn't get down there. Our schedules weren't working. But it finally worked out that they were down at the REF Summer Conference in Florida, and Wendy, my wife, and I flew down there to record them down there to get their vocals on it. So it was a little bit of a challenge, but I'm so thrilled with the way it turned out, and a lot of people really resonated with that song. So that's been really, just really gratifying.
And, you know, what's so great is just how all those things came together. Like you said, it's all been God bringing these moments and these sovereign stances together for His glory. And it's great to see in such a time as this, when there's all of this that we need. There's so many seems in the news. There's all of these people with their own ideas as to what the solution is. And here is a song that gives us a solution that will heal us, and it's found in the person and the work of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, and there's something about just digging in and working together, doing music, that, like, friendship gets born through there. Like, it's one thing to try to love people from a distance, but it's another thing to, you know, be on the same sports team or be in the same band. And I've always found in my own life, you know, that music has been a great melting pot and a great place for friendships to be born, even across some cultural divides.
Well, it is definitely an amazing album. It's so rewarding to see what you've been able to do throughout your ministry and to bring young students up in what seems to be so contradictory, given something old for the something new. But yet it is essential to see that that time that they're spending in these old texts to find the meat and the sustenance that is found in Jesus Christ. So thank you for the work that you do, and thank you for the music. Thank God for the music that it has produced.
Yeah, thank you, and I appreciate the opportunity to share a little bit about it.
We hope you enjoyed this interview made possible by our ministry at Songtime Radio. You can find out more information about our ministry by visiting our website at songtime.com, where you can find this and other interviews on our podcast series, as well as our weekday broadcast, which includes teaching, interviews, and music. We also want to encourage you to sign up for our free monthly newsletter. It's got encouraging articles, and there is no obligation. To find out more information about our ministry, again, visit our website at songtime.com. This ministry is made possible by people just like yourself. We are 100% supported by our listeners. So if you have been blessed today, why not join with the many voices together for that one message, the gospel of Jesus Christ, with your donation to the Songtime Ministry. To make a donation, you can do so online at our website at songtime.com, as well as by mail. Write to us at Songtime Radio, P.O. Box 100, Barnstable, Massachusetts, 02630, or give us a call. Make a donation over the phone. It's 508-362-7070. On behalf of our entire Songtime staff and our own Dr. John DeBrine, the founder here at Songtime, who encourages you to grow in grace and not groan in disgrace, from Cape Cod, I'm Adam Miller. God bless.